Well, this morning I want you to go back to the book of John. That is where we have been each week for a while now. We have come to John 19, and this morning we are going to be looking at that section. And also you'll want to have Luke 23. Hold on to that passage as well, Luke chapter 23. To say it once again, this is the section known as the Passion Week, the Sufferings of Christ. This is the week that Jesus goes through, the passage at least shows us, Jesus goes through six trials. He stands before the Jewish leaders three times. He stands before the Roman authorities three times. Six trials that Jesus goes through. And then he is crucified, and we will see that next week. But in this chapter 19, we have the crucifixion of Jesus. This started at midnight on Thursday. We're now into Friday morning as we come to John chapter 19, and this will be the third of the Roman trials, the third of the Gentile trials that Jesus has to face. Well, several years ago, Mel Gibson and others put together a movie called The Passion of Christ, and that was very probably realistic depiction. I did not actually see the movie. I just heard a lot about it and read a lot about it. A depiction of this particular week. The one thing that critics had about the movie, though, was the why of it. They did not tell you why it happened. They told you what happened, but it was weak on telling you the why of it. Why did Jesus go through all of that? In some ways, he could have looked like a victim. In some ways, he could have looked like he got caught up in some movement, and it was just a thing gone bad, a cause gone bad. But the reason Jesus went through all of the events of chapter 18 and 19 and 20 is because God planned it that way. He was no victim. He has lived 33 years for the events of chapter 18 and 19. He has come to the point where it all culminates, where this is what it's all about. He came to die. That is the why of it. He came to give his life a ransom for many. It pleased the Lord to crush him, Isaiah 53 says. It pleased the Lord to make him a guilt offering so that he could justify the many. That is what we see in Isaiah 53. He came to do the Father's will. He came, regardless of what evil men intended, God sovereignly ordained the events that we're reading about in John 18 and John 19. He orchestrates it all to satisfy the Father's wrath. He is the propitiation for our sin. He is the payment for our sin. He is the satisfaction for God's wrath for us. So that's important to remember as we look at these events. We've had three Jewish trials. One happened at midnight with Annas, the former high priest. We saw another in the middle of the night with the Sanhedrin, a portion of the Sanhedrin. And then we saw another at sunrise with the full Sanhedrin right before they take them to the first Roman trial, which was before Pilate. And last week we looked at Pilate as he tried Jesus in the trial as it ended at the end of chapter 18. And this morning we come into chapter 19. And Pilate is declaring him innocent. Pilate does not want, Pilate's biggest concern is Pax Romana. His biggest concern is Roman peace. His biggest concern is to keep peace in the empire. It's one thing Caesar did not like is when any of his conquered territories became disruptive, and he's doing everything he can to keep Roman peace. Is this Jew a threat to Roman rule? That's the question that he is concerned about. That's the only thing he is concerned about. The Jews have their issues that they bring before Pilate, religious issues. Those are not Pilate's concern. But is he a threat to Roman rule? Because the prosperity of the empire is what matters most to Pilate. And as he interrogates Jesus, he realizes that though Jesus is calling himself a king, he is no threat to the empire, and he says, I find no guilt in this man. He says that about three times in the trial. But we see in chapter 19 that he does decide to scourge Jesus, which is interesting. He's innocent, but we're going to scourge him. And that's what he does. To placate the high priest, to placate the religious leaders. I got to do something to this guy. Maybe this will suffice them if I scourge him. And that leads us into the third trial. But I want you to know there is a trial before this trial. And that is why I take you to Luke 23 just to briefly look at this second trial that precedes the third trial that we're looking at here in John chapter 19. Go to Luke chapter 23. This is a trial that takes place before Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas is who Jesus is going to be standing for before in this particular trial. Luke 23, verse 1, the whole body of them got up and brought him before Pilate. This is at the beginning, and this is when the Sanhedrin had finished their third trial, and they take him to Pilate at sunrise. They began to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation, forbidding to pay taxes and make all these false accusations. Pilate eventually says, I find no guilt in this man. They kept insisting, verse 5, he stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting, notice, from Galilee, even as far as this place. Well, the word Galilee got Pilate thinking. When Pilate heard it, verse 6 says, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was in Jerusalem at that time. He was there because there was a big feast of Passover, and he would be there to be a part of that, to be a part of that celebration as well. And like I said, this is Herod Antipas, because there's a lot of Herods in the Bible. I want you to know the distinction between the Herods. This is the second Roman trial. The book of John does not record what I just read to you, anything I'm about to read to you. The book of John, this happens between Pilate's first trial and Pilate's third trial. We have this trial taking place. I've introduced all the other interrogators to you. I introduced Caiaphas and Annas. I've introduced Pilate to you. Let me introduce Herod Antipas, or Herod, to you. Let's just start with the one you are aware of, Herod the Great. He is the head of the clan, Herod the Great. He was the one who was most known for his political and architectural skills, astronomy. He was a brilliant man. He built, he was rebuilding the temple. It was Herod's temple. Wasn't completed yet, but it was in the process of being built. It's being used, but it was still things to be built on it. He built the fortress at Masada. That is Herod the Great. That's not the Herod we're talking about in John 19. Or Luke 23. That's not this Herod. The Herod I'm talking about right now was a Herod who was the one who was around at the birth of Jesus, put out the tax. Caesar declared a tax, and everyone had to go and pay their taxes to their region. He's the one that put all the babies to death. That's Herod the Great. He was a very jealous man. He had one of his wives killed, but he had a lot of them. But he had one of them killed, some of his sons killed, because he feared someone was going to try to take over his rule. He was the one that basically historians tell us he knew nobody was going to cry at his funeral. So he had all the wealthy Jewish leaders of Jerusalem rounded up and arrested. And at the moment of his death, he wanted them all executed to make sure that somebody was crying in the city. That's how he knew how much he was hated by the people that he ruled over. Fortunately, it never got carried out, but that was something that he wanted to see happen. This man was impressive, but he was a murderer. And he's not the Herod I'm talking about in Luke 23. This man I'm talking about in Luke 23 is one of his sons, Herod Antipas. And when Herod died, Herod the Great died, in his will, he had his kingdom divided between three sons. Herod Antipas was given the region of Galilee. He was given the region to the north in Palestine. This Herod Antipas ruled for 42 years. Herod Antipas was a king for many, many years. This is the Herod that was around in the ministry of John the Baptist. You may recall that situation. This is the Herod that Jesus called a fox. This was the Herod that was a political survivor, just like his father. He would have people killed. And he gets into the situation with John the Baptist because what happened was he had a brother named Philip. Philip was married to Herodias. Philip and Herodias go to Rome. Herod Antipas goes to Rome and steals his brother's wife, Herodias. Man, you got a soap opera going now. Goes back, and a war breaks out between his former wife's father and Herod Antipas. As you can imagine, the father of his former wife gets upset. Anyway, the point is, he's with Herodias. Herodias is the woman who had his daughter dance for Herod Antipas and get Herod Antipas to have his head cut, John the Baptist's head cut off. That's Herodias. She was the one who did not like it that John the Baptist would go around saying, "You're immoral for taking your brother's wife." Herod Antipas felt guilty about it. He arrested John the Baptist. We're told in one of the other Gospels that Herod Antipas would sit and talk to John for hours on end, just talking to him. It wasn't he who necessarily wanted to see John the Baptist killed, but the point is, he felt guilty about it. And he thinks Jesus is John the Baptist come back from the dead. That's what he thinks. He hears about his power. He hears about his following. He thinks John the Baptist has come back. The man won't stop haunting me. He felt that kind of guilt over what he had done. So Herod Antipas is in town in Jerusalem. And Herod Antipas is, John the Baptist is gone off the scene. And Herod Antipas comes back, comes into town, and he basically takes an opportunity at this point to have this trial with John the Baptist. Let me tell you about two other Herods you hear about. You hear about Herod Agrippa the First. He's in Acts 12. He's the Herod who had Herod Day. Everybody called him a god, and he got eaten by worms. That's the one you read about in Acts chapter 12. But these guys are all related. You have Herod Agrippa the Second. He was later in Acts 26 with the Apostle Paul. That is also a relative of all these Herods. And Paul respected that Herod. That Herod said, "I almost became a Christian. I almost believed what you were saying. You almost convinced me, Paul." Paul had kind words to say about him in Acts 25 and 26. But this morning I'm talking about Herod Antipas. I'm talking about the Herod that John 19 fits in there between the two trials of Pilate. The Herod of Luke 23 here. That's the Herod we're talking about. And he's in Jerusalem, and Pilate sees an opportunity to pass Jesus off onto him because he finds out Jesus is from Galilee. Most of Jesus' ministry was focused in the region of Galilee. And so, you know, this is an opportunity to get somebody else to look at this case besides me. Look at verse 8 of Luke 23. "Now Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he wanted to see him for a long time because he'd been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him." He just wants to see some miracles. "I've heard about him. I want to see some." Verse 9, "He questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing." Jesus was not going to entertain him with miracles, and Jesus was not even going to give this fox any information about anything. Herod's hope did not come true. The interview just really didn't go anywhere. Jesus wasn't going to be a magician for him, things like that. Verse 10 tells us, "And the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing Jesus vehemently, and Herod with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate." And so he mocked him, sends him back to Pilate. And that's where we come to the third trial in John chapter 19. Verse 12 of Luke 23 says, "Now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, for before they had been enemies with each other." In verse 13, "Pilate summoned the chief priests and rulers of the people and said to them, 'You brought this man to me as one who incites the people. And having examined him before you, I found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you made against him.'" That's 23:14. And that leads us into the third trial in John 19. And so he decides to punish Jesus. Go back to John 19. He decides to punish Jesus, and he wants to release him. His verdict is not guilty, but he decides to scourge him, like I said earlier, to somehow accommodate these Jewish religious leaders. He knows they are jealous. Matthew 27 says, Pilate knew that these religious leaders were jealous of Jesus and the following that he had and the popularity that he had with the people and the fear that they had that he was going to pull people away from them or even cause the Romans to take away their positions. And so we see in 19:1, Pilate at this third trial, the final trial, Pilate scourges Jesus. Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him. This is a strategy to whip him and flog him. Carson, in his commentary, talks about three levels of scourgings. They were lighter to more severe. The significance of saying this is the more severe scourging is because this scourging is a scourging that would precede crucifixion. And so most commentators, I read a lot of commentaries, but most commentators will say this is the most severe of the scourgings. Let me read to you what Milne says about the scourging and what a scourging was. "The victim was stripped, bound to a post or pillar, beaten by a number of torturers until the latter grew tired and the flesh of the victim hung in bleeding shreds. In the provinces such as Judea, this was a task of soldiers." Soldiers would do this. "In the case of slaves or criminals such as Jesus, scourges or whips were used. Leather thongs, often fitted with spikes or several pieces of bone, sharpened bone, or lead joined to form a chain. It's not surprising to hear that prisoners not infrequently collapsed and died under the procedure." Just imagine that, what Jesus was going through right now. "Declared innocent by Pilate, but yet to go through something this severe and this cruel. It would expose muscles and your insides, tearing away flesh. Few remain conscious during it. Some even died, and some went raving mad, one commentator says. Verse 2, "The soldiers continue mocking Jesus." Notice, "And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and put a purple robe on him." Probably took from a date palm tree. That'd be a common tree with thorns in it, a limb with thorns in it. "Twisted it together for a crown of thorns. Shoved that into his skull." Imagine that. And they just join in the mockery, kind of barracks mockery. You know, this is happening behind the scenes. The Jews would not go into the praetorium. Jews would not go into where Pilate was. So this is kind of out of their view. But the point is, this is how the soldiers treated him, verse 3 says. "And they began to come up to him and say, 'Hail, King of the Jews,' and to give him slaps in the face." The "Hail, King of the Jews" was a term used for Roman Caesars. Hail to Caesar. You know, they're saying hail to the King of the Jews, just mocking him. They didn't like Jews anyway. The soldiers didn't like Jews anyway. And here's one who claims to be a king. Well, let's mock his claim that he's a king. He slaps to the face. One gospel says he was hit on the head with the scepter they gave to him. He's beaten, blows with the stick, blows to the face, blows to the body, wearing the robe and a crown. And so they're inside, and so Pilate comes back out. Verse 4, "Pilate came out again and said to them, 'Behold, I am bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him.'" So here's this bloodied Jesus beaten Jesus, skin shredded, looking up, looking out, whatever, presented to this crowd, and Pilate says, I find no guilt in him. He presents them to him. He's hoping, like I said, this will suffice. Maybe they will see this and think enough is enough. Maybe they will say, okay, he's paid the penalty for his crimes. Maybe they will say that. And this isn't the first time he said not guilty. He said it in the first trial. He's saying it again. And the Sanhedrin are hearing a verdict they do not want to hear. They are hearing a verdict that does not fit with their intentions on why they brought about this trial. They want crucifixion. They want execution. They can't execute anybody, but the Romans can. And we brought him to you so you could do the job. That is their intention. That is what they want to see happen. They want crucifixion. Jesus then came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, behold the man. Not standing tall and elegant, but just beaten nearly to death. Here is the man. Here is the man you make these accusations of. Here he is, beaten nearly to death. Verse 6 says, so when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out saying, crucify, crucify. Pilate said to them, frustrated, take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. His scheme has not worked. They are not satisfied with a scourging. They are not satisfied with a bloodied, beaten Jesus. They're not satisfied. So he throws it back at them. He says, you crucify him. You crucify him. You do that. Knowing they can't do that, but just in frustration, throwing it back at them. Take him yourselves. He is not guilty, and I am not going to do it. You know, sometimes we get the impression that there's a large crowd gathered around. This is early in the morning. I don't think we have any true evidence that there is a large crowd at this point. I think it's mostly just the religious leaders, a small gathering of people at this particular trial. Roman trials by Roman governors who would sit in judgment of things like this would happen early in the morning, as I've told you in previous weeks. So this is very early in the morning, maybe getting close to 9 o'clock, maybe somewhere between 6 a.m. and 9 o'clock by this third trial. It seems to be just the chief priests and their cronies who are all gathered here, more than the large crowds of people. The Passover meal has been eaten the night before. Think about this. The Passover meal was eaten the night before. That would have been Thursday. All of Jesus' followers have fled, and so there's just not many people around. People have not started waking up yet or getting out about the activities of the day. But things are moving quickly, as I've told you in previous weeks. The whole event has started at midnight the night before, and we're just here at about 8 hours later. And you see that it's just rapid, rapid speed. And most of Jerusalem has no idea, probably at this point, what's going on at this point. Well, third time, Pilate is announcing in this verse that Jesus is not guilty. That's interesting. He says he's not guilty. And he's beaten and flogged nearly to death. And if truth be known, that this is exactly what God said would happen. This is exactly what God said was required to pay the penalty of our sin. The wrath of God. This is exactly what needed to happen and must happen. You think about the scene here. In the Old Testament sacrificial system, the high priest would have to inspect every lamb that was brought for sacrifice to make sure that that lamb was spotless, to make sure that that lamb had no blemish. That was required. The high priest would inspect it before it would be sacrificed. Think about this. Pilate sort of sits in that position at the moment, as the high priest. Pilate is saying, I find nothing wrong with this man. He is innocent. He is not guilty. And that is exactly what God required to be the sacrifice for our sin. It's an incredible thought that perfect, sinless Christ, innocent of everything, would stand here, no guilt, no blemish, and be declared over and over again by Pilate, not guilty, not guilty. And that would be what God would require him to be. So Pilate says, take him for yourself. I find no guilt in him. Verse 7, the Jews answered him, we have a law, and by that law he ought to die because he made himself out to be the Son of God. They're getting frustrated with Pilate, no doubt. They kind of reveal their true intention here now. And they say, this man deserves death because he has blasphemed God. He has violated Leviticus 24:16. He has said something about God that is not true. He has said that he is the Son of God. He has made that claim. You may not think he's broken any of your laws, but he has broken ours by this blasphemy. And that law says that you must be put to death. Stoning would be the way you'd be put to death for that kind of blasphemy. But we can't kill him, but you can. He has violated our law, Leviticus 24:16. That's their true concern. That is what really bothers them the most. That is something that they've threatened to kill Jesus for before, when he has claimed to be the Son of God. They knew that Pilate may not be concerned about that, but we find him guilty for breaking our laws, for breaking things that are very clearly scandalous in the eyes of our religion. Son of God, two things think about with the word Son of God. Two ways to think about this and two ways it's used in the Bible. The first, it's a messianic title. It's a title for the Messiah. It's a title that came out of the Davidic covenant. It's a title you see in 2 Samuel 7. I will be a father to him. Son of God, I will be a father to him. He will be a son to me. That's in 2 Samuel 7. Psalm 2, verse 7, you are my son. Pay homage to the son. My son, talking about Son of God. Psalm 89, he will cry out to me. You are my father, my firstborn. That's language speaking of Son of God, God the Father, God the Son. And Jesus claimed that. He claimed to be Messiah. He claimed to be the one who fulfilled those prophecies. But he's not necessarily being executed by the Jews for that reason. The real reason the Son of God was so offensive to them is found in John 5. Listen to this. Jesus heals a man on the Sabbath. Jesus is breaking their Sabbath rules. Jesus says in verse 16 says, for this reason the Jews were persecuting Jesus because he was doing things on the Sabbath. verse 17, but he answered them, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. He's saying, God works, I work. I'm the Lord of the Sabbath, he says in another place. I control the Sabbath. Verse 18, for this reason the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, not only for breaking the Sabbath, but also he was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. That's the reason. He claimed to be God. He claimed to be equal to God. He claimed to be the same essence as God. That claim was most offensive and most heretical in their eyes, that he would claim to be the same and equal to God. We learned with Todd in our men's breakfast recently, great job on the Trinity, but we have one essence, one God. We have three persons. Jesus, one person, two natures, human nature and divine nature. Jesus says, I am working because God is working. And if God is working, I am working. In John 8:56, another way that he uses Son of God, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it and was glad. So the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old. Have you seen Abraham? Have you seen Abraham? You talk about Abraham. You're only 50 years old. How can you talk like you've seen Abraham? Have you seen Abraham? And he says to them, before Abraham was born, I am. I have always existed. I'm eternal. Only God is eternal. It's claims like this. It goes on to say, therefore they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. John 10:30, Jesus says, I am the Father of one. They picked up stones to stone him. Leviticus says, stone him. That's what they wanted to do. He claimed to be the Son of God. Messianic, yes, but also equal to God. And we saw it throughout the book of John. That's blasphemy. And that's what they throw out to Pilate. Look at verse 8 back in John 19. Therefore, when Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. Oh my, am I dealing with divinity here? Am I dealing with something more than man here? Pilate starts to panic. He knows of Jesus' power. In Matthew 27, Pilate's wife has a dream, a bad nightmare about this man Jesus, and warns her husband, don't have anything to do with him, Matthew 27 says. Pilate's got a lot going on here. You know, it really wasn't a big deal to Romans for somebody to have, quote, divine power. Caesar had a divine nature. It was not unusual in the Roman way of thinking for a man to have some kind of divine influence or divine power. So that really isn't something that they would be concerned about, but something to be scared about. I certainly don't want to put to death a man who has divinity, any kind. So he starts to panic even more. F.F. Bruce said it this way, if a man claimed to be the Son of God, that was no blasphemy to Pilate. That man was a man with some quality of divine about him, just like Caesar. Verse 9 says, and he entered the praetorium. This is Pilate, verse 9, again, and said to Jesus, where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. Pilate knows injustice is being done here. Pilate knows that this is not a fair trial. Pilate knows that this is he's being manipulated in some way. He's starting to sense that. Jesus gives no answer to his questions. He just accepts the charges. Where are you from? Think about that. Jesus had been saying throughout his ministry where he was from. He said in John 6:51, I am the living bread that came out of heaven. I am the living bread that came out of heaven. He says in verse 23 of John chapter 8, you are from below, I am from above. You are from this world, I am not of this world. That's his question. His question is, are you divine? Is there something about you that's not just a man? And Jesus did not answer him with these things, but through his ministry, that is what he would say about where he was from. And you can't help but seeing that Jesus is not really the one on trial here, but it's really Pilate at this point. Pilate is really having to figure out what's going to happen and what he's going to do. Pilate is on trial. What is he going to do with Jesus? The Jesus who he thinks is innocent, the Jesus who he thinks has been mistreated by these Roman leaders, the Jesus who has humbly gone through these events, the Jesus who told him in the first trial that my kingdom is not of this world and my kingdom is no threat to you because my people are not going to try to riot in the streets and take over your kingdom. That's not how it will happen. Verse 10, Pilate responds in anger. He says this, you do not speak to me, to Jesus. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you? He does have authority. That's true. He does have authority. But theologically, it's not true. Jesus points it out to him in the next verse. You would have authority, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. Just look at the last part of that verse first. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. Probably speaking about Caiaphas, the religious leaders. They have all the knowledge and all the information and all the scriptures about the Messiah, about me, and yet they have delivered me over for this. They blinded themselves and they've rejected all the truth that they have. They are more guilty, he is saying. They are more guilty than even you. Jesus said, no one takes my life away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. Pilate, it's not you that, it's not just that you have authority. You have authority that's been given to you, but I have authority to lay down my life. This event is not about your power. This event is not about your sovereignty over me. Acts 4:27, we looked at this a couple weeks ago. For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur. The religious leaders are not in control. God is in control of these events. And God will judge, and God will get vengeance on those who are guilty here. And Pilate, you have authority, but it's a delegated authority. It's authority that you've been given by God, and it's limited in what you can actually do. So Jesus faces death with confidence. He knows he will be raised to given a kingdom one day. Verse 12, as a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. All of a sudden, the religious leaders are loyal to Caesar. See that? All of a sudden, Caesar is their king. All of a sudden, Caesar is a good guy. You see the manipulation here. You see the intimidation that is now moving toward Pilate, trying to intimidate him. You are no friend of Caesar's if you do this. They were appealing to Caesar. They were going to appeal to Caesar. That's what they're basically threatening here. Tiberius was Caesar. Tiberius was a guy like all the other Roman leaders who was vicious and would cut off your head if he thought you were trying to rebel against him. Tiberius was not an easy man to work with for Pilate or for any of his other vassal kings or governors. Tiberius was, like I said, a man who was easily threatened, and if he thought someone was out there claiming to be a king and Pilate didn't do anything about it, just imagine the case they would have. Just imagine what the religious leaders could do. And Pilate is no dummy. He has had to deal with this before. There is, history tells us the Jews had gone to the Caesar before to complain about Pilate. And so now here's another opportunity they have to go back to Caesar to make an appeal about how Pilate has let a guy off the hook. Think about this. They would say something like this. They would say, he's threatening the peace. This Jesus was threatening the peace. There's all kinds of evidence. We had six trials. They would say that he has a large following. They would say he came riding into the city on Palm Sunday and people were hailing him as a king. They would say he has miraculous powers. They would say that People saw him terrorize the temple area, throw out the money changers, turn over all the tables, run the animals out of the temple area. He's disruptive. He threatens the peace of Rome. He threatens the peace in Jerusalem. You don't go around doing that to anybody's religion. Even Tiberius would say that. I may not believe in your religion, but you don't treat somebody's religion like that. Just imagine what these religious leaders could do to Pilate. They could take that kind of case before Tiberius. And they could say to Tiberius, and all of these things he's done, all this guy wants to do is give him a beating, give him a whipping, give him a scourging, which he could heal, which he'll heal from and start terrorizing all over again. Pilate knows that. Pilate knows they've got that kind of case against him. He knows that's not going to go well with Tiberius. So you see the manipulation that takes place. You see the control of Pilate that takes place. You see how Pilate has totally lost control of this whole scene. Tiberius would have thought all of that was very bad, and he knew that. And Pilate knows, I'm not going to let this Jesus take away my office as governor. I'm not going to let him do that. Verse 13, I'm just going to kill the guy. Therefore, when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at the place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Verse 14, now it was the day of preparation for the Passover. It was about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, behold your king. Let me just give you two time references in verse 14 real quick. It says, day of preparation for the Passover. If you read that, you might think, oh, this is the day before they eat the Passover meal. That's not true. They ate the Passover meal the day before. This is the day of preparation before the Sabbath. Read down in verse 31. The Sabbath was a high Sabbath day. You see verse 31? The day of preparation, the bodies would remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath was a high day. So this is the day of preparation of the Passover, the high Sabbath Passover. This is a Friday. This is the day you prepare for Sabbath any normal week, but this is a special week. This is the week of Passover, so this is a preparation for the Passover that happens during the week of Passover and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. This is a high Sabbath, it tells us in verse 31. That's just a calendar mark or a time marker for you. When you read that, it could be confusing. Wow, this must be Wednesday. No, this is Friday. This is the day of preparation of Passover week for the high Sabbath, which will take place the next day. Sixth hour, some concern about that. Mark says third hour. Some have tried to say different ways of calculating time. Very possible. They didn't have watches. You know, nobody had a watch. Nobody knew what time it actually was. I would say somewhere between the third hour and the sixth hour would be the best way to look at that. Third hour would be 9 a.m. Sixth hour would be could easily be noon that day. Somewhere between 9 and noon. That's what most of the commentators I have read have said, and I think they are accurate in their reasoning behind that. And so, behold your king, verse 14 says. And then verse 15, Pilate officially presents Jesus to the leaders of Israel, and they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? The chief priest answered, oh, this is crazy. We have no king but Caesar. Wow, that is twisted. John 1:11 says, he came to his own, and his own rejected him. That's exactly what happens. They rejected him. Matthew says they added these words. Think about this. May his blood be on us and our children. Think about that. May his blood be on us and our children. And when you study the history of the Jewish nation, you find out that was true. That was true. The Old Testament says that God was the king of Israel, and now these people are saying, Caesar is our king. How much they hated Christ and how much they wanted to see him die. They just killed the Prince of Peace, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, Isaiah 9 says. They just killed the one who will come forth to be a ruler in Israel, Micah 5 says. He will rise, he will be great. They just killed him. God has sent his son to be a king, and they've rejected him. We learned in John chapter 1 that he sent him into the world to explain God to us. They're about to kill the best sermon that God ever sent into the world to tell us about who God is. They refuse to hear it, and they're saying now, take him and crucify him. John, verse 16, we'll talk about this next week. He then handed him over to them to be crucified. This is why he came. This culminates, his purpose culminates here at the cross. That's what this is all about. That is why Jesus came into the world, to go to the cross for you and I, to die in our place, to suffer in our place, to take the wrath of God upon himself for us, to bear the thorns and the scourge and the crucifixion. He did all of that for us. He is not guilty. I'm guilty. You're guilty. You should go to that cross, not him. You should suffer that wrath, not him, not me. But excuse me, me or you, but not him. We should all be there, but he comes to do that for us. And next time we'll look at the actual crucifixion of Christ and the horrors of a crucifixion. He's already scourged. He's already half dead. He can't even carry his own cross. We'll see all those things next week. Father, thank you for your word this morning. Thank you for these truths. Thank you, God, that, Father, as we have looked at these things and just reminded of the historical truth of what our Savior experienced for us and went through for us and bled and eventually died for us. God, we are so reminded of the fact that he loved us so much that he willingly, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. God, we praise you and thank you that because he did that for us, we can gather in this room this morning as forgiven sinners, as forgiven transgressors, as those who have disobeyed you and turned away from you, and yet because of him, we can have hope and forgiveness. We love you in Christ's name. Amen.